Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from Netroots Nation 2011 in a huge, what appears to be an airport hangar somewhere in Minneapolis, Minnesota. This, of course, is not an airport hangar. It is a, I guess it's some type of conference area. I got here by walking through a very long hall that actually floats above the ground. They call it the Skywalk here in Minnesota, and it's a way that you can actually travel through a city without touching pavement, only dirty carpet. So we are here live at Netroots Nation, and we have some great shows for you. Hopefully, we'll see. I'm getting a little bit of an echo, and I'm going to have to switch my monitors. But I'm going to give you a running tally of every technical problem I have throughout the broadcast today. On the program today, at the very least, we're going to have David Dayan from Fire Dog Lake. Gaius Publius will be here from America Blog. We're going to have all sorts of people are going to be dropping by, and it's going to be great shows, so stick with us starting, well, I guess now. Huh. Let me just...
Am I up?
Ladies and gentlemen, David Dayan is here with us. David, welcome back to the Majority Report.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Sam.
So, David, well, let's...
I enjoyed the Skyway, too, by the way.
The Skyway is...
I think in the future, that is how all rich people will get to where they need to go.
That's right.
Without having to touch asphalt.
Let's talk about the Skyway just for one second, because I do want to make this a little bit meta, because... You know, I want to manish to know. I want to make this
here.
A little bit different. Yes.
Yeah.
This is my first time out here. I have never, I never really contemplated what the Skyway is, but it's basically like a long airport hallway that seems to be piggybacked on the back of all buildings here.
They have it in Des Moines too. I've never been to the one here, but they have it in Des Moines, and they have little shops and things in there. It's kind of like an upstairs version of what, you know, they have in Montreal with the subterranean kind of mall. So it's almost a mall as well as a Skyway in Des Moines it is. And maybe parts of Minneapolis as well, I'm not sure.
And you know, the interesting thing, you haven't been on this one.
I have been on this one. It was
it's weird.
A long way from the hotel into here.
It's weird because it's obviously very convenient, I guess, when it's really super cold.
Yeah. I mean, you have these places that go to sub-zero temperatures. You need something.
But they also don't make it, like, they could make it more like a street. Like, there could be newspapers there.
Right.
Or there could be, like, a bench where people could hang out or
a
kiosk.
I think Des Moines is a little more like
in a
that.
Way, you don't want people to sort of live up there either. It's
right.
Interesting. It's the future for everybody. Soon, we're all going to live in a massive plastic bubble anyways, because everything will be so
because
toxic.
The air and water and land will be so ravaged that
right.
we're going to have to build these structures climate controlled for ourselves.
Right. And, of course, they'll be paid for with public money, and then they'll be privatized so that we
right.
can pay some corporation some type of toll to walk through the sky.
An air fee or
it's going to be,
yes,
it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm sure most of our legislators will be owning the corporations that own the sky. It's the future is so bright.
The future is now here in Minneapolis.
All right. Let's talk a couple of things. We could talk about Wiener. Wiener apparently is going to resign. This is going to be announced at 1:30 today or something.
Yeah.
The only thing that's interesting to me about this, so let's just spend a minute on it.
Okay.
It's not awkward that we're not talking about it at this point. Why are you doing this at 1:30 on a Thursday? I mean, isn't this like a 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon type of thing? Or,
you know, this has been building, I guess, over the last week when Pelosi and the gang made this joint statement, which, you know, it's so hard to get Democrats on message, but on
this,
they were able to make a joint statement. It's been building pretty much since then, and you know, there's this weird dichotomy where they said, we want to get back to talking about Medicare, but instead they were sending out joint statements about Anthony Weiner resigning instead of just talking about Medicare.
Yeah, I noticed that. There was some sort of left-wing mass media programs which had the same thing.
Yeah.
Weiner is a distraction, and now 45 minutes of Weiner.
Exactly.
So, but,
and as I understand, I mean, you're in New York, so you would know better, but the guy was getting redistricted out of his seat anyway, correct?
I mean, certainly at this point he was.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there was some question. But I think, you know, from everything that as far as I know, the guy was going to run for mayor anyways. And that he was going to leave office anyways. And I don't think this hurt him that much politically there. I think that what happened is that there were other members. My guess is that members of the Democratic Party were convinced that it was.
Right.
And they said, look, you know, if you're going to have a future, maybe you can run for mayor. I mean, you know, after I saw that press conference, I was like, this dude's going to get 5 terms. Bloomberg had 3. He's going to have 5 terms.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if he gets a second act, but, you know, I guess he needed some time off to contemplate.
I know he's anti-bicycle, so, you know, screw him.
Right.
All right, so that being that, I mean, I think it's a shame that we can't, but yes, move on. Who cares? I mean, this is the least relevant thing that I could imagine we could talk about.
I mean, the one thing I'll say about it is that, you know, you hear Democratic leaders say that this is a distraction, maybe it'll hurt our efforts to pin this ending Medicare or whatever it is on the Republicans. But I think what will hurt that the most is if you start cutting social programs like Medicaid, which is what we heard today.
Right. Okay. Yes, exactly. I mean, that was also, you know, one of the things that people were like, this is a distraction. From what?
Right.
Like, you know, who is this distracting from? I mean,
right.
I think there was as much from the Democrats to gain from this distraction as the Republicans, because what is going on in these budget talks is reprehensible. And it's basically, and, you know, all roads lead towards you can fuck over the poor and nobody really cares.
Right. They don't have as
so
much of an
tell us about the Medicaid.
Stickers. Yeah. So we heard today, there's a Wall Street Journal article, obviously these debt limit talks are ongoing. Republicans have demanded a equal number of cuts to the dollar amount increase of the debt limit, but new taxes or revenue increases of any kind have been taken off the table.
Right.
Democrats took benefit cuts to Medicare off the table, so what's left? The safety valve is Medicaid. And what we learned in this article is that major cuts for Medicaid are on the
table. Back up for 1 second. Just so people understand, you know, because I think I always operate with the assumption that everybody understands what the difference between Medicare and Medicaid is.
Yes.
And I'm not quite convinced that people are.
I'm not convinced that anyone knows the difference, and that's why I think Medicaid has high numbers in terms higher numbers than you would think, given the constituency it serves.
Right.
Then.
All right, so break it down. What's
the
Medicare? What's Medicaid?
Medicare serves the over 65 community. It's a single payer system for senior citizens.
40 million Americans? More.
That sounds about right for Medicare.
Okay.
Yeah. Medicaid also serves in the range of, you know, 30 or 40 million Americans. That's for the poor. And there are, it's a state-federal partnership where in the states there are programs for health care for the poor that run through the states, but they are subsidized generously through Medicaid. Now, the way it works now is that they are paid for based on need. There's an enrollment strategy, and whatever the enrollment is, a percentage of that is paid for by the federal government. What was in the Ryan budget and what the Republicans want to do is block grant Medicaid. So there's a set amount of money that goes to the states. It's capped.
It's capped.
And that's just an invitation to cut the rolls. Millions of people will be thrown off the Medicaid rolls if that goes forward. The government will save money, but it'll be at the expense of poor people who can't afford health.
Well, sure, I could come up. I mean, you don't have to be an economist. You know how the government can save money? Shut down.
Yeah.
If we had no government services whatsoever, we would save money.
In fact, we could balance the budget.
That way. We could completely balance the budget, except for the people who are actually crunching the numbers on the balancing of the budget.
Right.
I mean,
those people would be out of work, so it would be hard
to know.
Theoretically, we would balance.
Right. We would all just have to depend on Joe Scarborough to tell us this, or someone else. Now Medicaid is. But there's another element about Medicaid, and I should say that the incident of children who are on Medicaid, and there's a story today in the Times, I guess it was today or yesterday, in the Times, basically showing that Medicaid's payments are so low as it is now that more often than not, people who are on Medicaid are turned away from hospitals. Because unless you have an emergency, you know, everybody gets
medical care. This is a problem with Medicaid. It's also somewhat of a success story of Medicaid, because Medicaid is a very cheap program to run on a per-person basis.
It's the cheapest.
It's the cheapest, cheaper than Medicare, because you're dealing with somewhat, you know, obviously you're not dealing with seniors as much. It's a healthier community. But, you know, the substantial amount of money that Medicare pays out is for senior citizens, and a lot of people don't realize that.
Particularly
nursing homes.
Medicaid.
Yes.
So
most people who are in nursing homes, a substantial amount, are getting the money to remain in the nursing home through the Medicaid program. So cutting or block granting Medicaid is an invitation to have millions of seniors have to go back and move in with their kids.
Because
that's what we're talking about.
What happens is that when you are a senior and you go into a home, at one point, what happens with, I don't know, the majority of people, probably the majority of people, you run out of money.
Absolutely. And then Medicaid kicks in.
And then Medicaid kicks in because you have now reached this wonderful threshold of being poor enough to be eligible for Medicaid.
Right.
And so
it's called dual eligible. If you're eligible in Medicaid and Medicare. In fact, Democrats have said they want to save money by moving dual eligibles into Medicaid because it's cheaper to run the program. That was one of their savings ideas for Medicaid. But if you're cutting Medicaid, I mean, understand, the Affordable Care Act, fully half of the coverage expansion in the Affordable Care Act is through the expansion of Medicaid. They gave extra money to Medicaid programs and said to the states that you're going to up this, we're going to pay for it, and 16 million people are supposed to get, out of the 31 million that are supposed to get coverage through the Affordable Care Act, 16 million is through Medicaid expansion. So if you cut it now, you can kiss that goodbye.
Right.
So this is essentially tied to the success or failure of the Obama health care program.
But that's in 2014. That's not kicking in until 2014, right? I mean, politically speaking, and even policy speaking, you know, the horizon here seems to be exactly, what are we, 6 months? I mean, the horizon here seems to be to November 5th or whatever it is.
Right.
These prayers, November 5th, 2012, I should say. Hopefully the economy can hold out. I mean, because let's continue on with your point, because I want to just shift over to the other aspect of this deal that we're hearing about.
I mean, so what you're talking about when you're talking about cutting Medicaid, another way that they might go about this is through cutting off the so-called maintenance of effort requirements. In essence, if a state tries to cut its Medicare rolls, it tries to drop the eligibility standard, the federal government said, well, we're paying for a lot of this. You have to keep up a maintenance of effort. You cannot go below a certain threshold. And, you know, we'll give you the money. And if you don't, then we'll revoke it. We'll take it back. What they might do is eliminate the maintenance of effort requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Gives the states flexibility. This is what Republican governors, this is the euphemism they use, is flexibility.
Right.
And what that means is the ability to kick people off of Medicaid, kick people off of their rolls, and save them a lot of money. Because Medicaid is a drain on state budgets, obviously. It's one of the most expensive programs that states need, you know, to use. The answer to that is not to kill the maintenance of effort requirements and allow the states to kill their Medicaid programs. It's to federalize Medicaid so that there's a smooth standard across all states and it's portable. That's the way that would be the smart version.
Because you would be eliminating a massive amount of bureaucracy.
And you would be killing, you would be eliminating all of these complex state structures.
Right.
You would be saving state budgets. That is probably the best way of you know, normalizing this program. Instead, we're going to have it so that every state could be different. So one state might be very generous and go up to 100% of poverty or 115% of poverty. And another state, you can't enroll unless, you know, you literally are a ward of the state. You know?
Right.
So it's a very dangerous situation. And I think you're right that people don't know the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. And that actually might save this because polls show that Medicaid is very popular, but I think Medicaid is popular because anything with Meta and the government in it is
right,
very popular.
Right, right. I think that people aren't quite sure what the distinction between Medicare and Medicaid is, and Medicare is wildly popular because, well, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, if Medicare and Medicaid get cut, either one of them, it's not. Those 75-year-old men and women who are necessarily going to be making up the difference. It's their 40-year-old kids.
Absolutely.
It's their 50-year-old kids.
Cutting Medicare is tantamount to the Have Your Mother-in-Law Move In With You Act.
Right.
I mean, that's what it should be called.
Right. Now, let's have Josh Horton's going to join us.
Okay.
Hey, wait a second. Here, why don't we do this? Josh, let's put this microphone over there and swing a chair around.
Okay.
And
you got it. Right.
We are. So we were just
talking about
the idea of Josh Horton. Now of can I see your badge, Josh?
Yes.
I mean, the Majority Report audience knows you, of course, as the MR1's producer. But now you're with Progressive United. This is the tell us about just briefly.
Progressive United was founded by former Senator Russ Feingold in February of this year, and the point of Progressive United is it's specific to standing up and fighting the corporate influence in politics, both on the legislative side and on the election side. It's largely a response to Citizens United. We'll support candidates that stand up for these things. We'll pick fights with everything from the Republican presidential nominee to Democrats who are, you know, taking a little corporate money and not.
No, Democrats don't do that. I refuse to believe that.
Well,
forget it. No, no way. No, not.
They run different kind of campaigns.
That's right. That's true.
They go after hedge fund managers and investment fund managers. It's the different kind of campaign.
All right, so, okay.
Right, the Wall Street executives are wearing blue ties.
Okay, that's right. Yes.
Different kind of campaign.
They're the one. That's right. They're the ones who, who just cannot stomach the fact that they're affiliated with a party that thinks that gay people should be, second-class citizens.
Big differences.
Big differences. So, all right, well, with your introduction said, let's talk about this whole payroll tax reduction. You're both aware of it, right? That's
yes.
Being floated as part of this debt deal.
Mm-hmm.
We know that in the big tax deal in the fall, there was a 1% payroll, 2% on the
employee side, 2%.
No.
That was for 2011.
On the employee side?
Yeah. That's what,
2%.
Currently, right now, there is a 2% reduction in the payroll tax.
I thought there was a
1%. On the employee side.
Now they want to do a 2% on the employer side.
Right, and extend, because this ends in 2011. This ends at the end of the year, and I don't think anyone believes that unemployment is going to be at, 5% at the end of the year. So, this, I don't know why they set it up. It's almost as if Mitt Romney set it up that at the end of this year, it's two very stimulative measures, the payroll tax, I mean, maybe it's stimulative, the employee side payroll tax, and definitely the unemployment insurance
right.
extension, both end at the end of 2011,
well,
right in time for the 2012
election. We know why this is the case. You know why this is the case. Joss, why is this the case?
I'm not sure. Tell me why it's the case.
Because these guys, there's a certain amount of incompetence here. There really is no other explanation. Because there really is no other explanation other than the fact that they are so bought into a certain ideology about economics that is proposed by Geithner. Because this would be political malfeasance beyond imagination unless they actually thought that they were out of the woods.
Well, and the other thing is it's not actually a surprise. We're saying, well, it runs out when it runs out. And you know, Dave was saying as if it was designed by Mitt Romney. We knew this at the time.
Absolutely.
People were raising this concern at the time. Sam was. This is going to run out right in the middle of a presidential election year.
Well, that's because you guys do not believe in the power of confidence. And if you give confidence to
the business community.
Right, to the business community and to the bondholders, then they make everything right.
Absolutely. Right. I wrote a story about this very issue for the American Prospect, and I think Larry Michel of the American Economic
Policy
Institute.
I don't doubt it. Everything I'm saying, I probably just got from what I read.
He said it best. He said, "This is what they do is they create a suboptimal policy, and then they say it is a wonderful policy. They don't say this is the best we can get, and we need a lot better. They say this is actually the thing that is the silver bullet that's going to make it.
You could be
talking
about the stimulus is the prime example.
And what
probably
Michelle said is that they take a tactic and elevate it to the level of principle. You know, they feel forced into deficit reduction, and so they rationalize that is a job creator, that deficit reduction, this expansion by contraction idea." And they know better. I mean, the economics of that is completely silly. But because they feel forced into it, they turn it into a principle.
Mike Konzackel, I can never pronounce his name, but
Mike
Rorty Baum,
yeah.
He wrote a piece very much like this about Geithner talking about arguing that the stimulus was sugar. If you just give money, it's sugar.
Right.
And he talks about there are two ways you could see this. One is, we need to do short-term stimulus, and we need to deal with the deficit so that from a political standpoint and even an economic standpoint...
to get the deal done.
To get the deal done, but we're also sending a signal to the bondholders that down the road we're going to deal with this, give them confidence. But now they seem to have even skipped that first part where they're just going directly to, we need to just help out the bondholders.
Right.
And so this is...
And what they're talking about with the employee side... Or maybe the employer side, payroll tax cut and extending it, is actually an attempt to go back to the first thing, to say we do actually need some stimulus now.
Right.
But what is that stimulus? When you cut the employer side of the payroll tax, what are you doing? You're just making it cheaper to hire. You're nudging the business community and saying, see, it's going to be cheap if you hire more people, or it's cheaper to keep on your payroll. You know, how many business tax cuts? I remember Obama bragging, 16 small business tax cuts we've done so far. There's a job hiring tax cut. These things haven't really worked to any fair degree.
Well, of course not, because look, the bottom line is, and I've been using this probably too much, this analogy, but if I own a bakery and I have one employee who makes 10 cakes a day, if I have some extra money, I'm not going to hire a second employee to make 20 cakes a day unless I've got people coming into the store to buy 20 cakes.
Absolutely.
I mean, because I'd be a moron to do that.
Right.
What I would be really smart to do is, hey, I don't have any more business, but I just increased my profits by 2% because I don't have to pay this dude as much.
Absolutely. They'll pocket the money.
Why am I going to risk hiring a second baker when I don't have people coming through the door to buy
it? It's cheaper to hire the second baker.
That's
don't you understand
I know
the
why.
New economy?
Because I believe in... I believe that my job as owning a bakery is to make my baker's life just a little bit easier. I'm going to split his work in half, even though I'm not going to make any more money. It's just absolutely ridiculous. All right, let me get... Because I know you have to go in a minute.
Yes.
But... You both have been here. You've been coming to Netroots Nation.
Every year. I've been to every one of them.
And I know you have, because you brought us here that first year to do the first radio broadcast ever.
That's right.
From what was Daily Kos. What's different now?
I think part of it is that, you know, it's looking around. The first Yearly Kos in 2006 in Las Vegas, you know, it really struck me. You looked around, it sort of looked like a PTA meeting. You know, it was, you know, moms and dads and people who felt sort of, you know, out in the wilderness. This is before the big, you know, midterm election in 06. You know, I think Democrats were really, it was, people were just so thrilled to be around other progressives who felt the same way that they did. And sort of embrace each other. And especially after, you know, progressivism, you know, in 04, 05, after John Kerry lost, you know, we were sort of in the dark. And, you know, people had, you know, been called, you know, tinfoil hat wearing, you know, crazy, dirty hippies. And to have sort of a space for everyone to sort of come together, I think was almost cathartic. That was the feeling in 2006. And it also had this weird feeling of almost walking on another planet because you're in this sort of dumpy casino in Las Vegas. And so everyone sort of felt this great feeling of liberation. And now, you know, I think that there's been a lot of positive sort of improvements in that station, you know, financially stable, you know, staff growth. You know, they have a real reach and leverage. You know, but there's differences. It's like, you know, it's much younger. And you see and I think that part of the reason why it's younger is there's staff here now.
Yeah.
Every political organization, you know, members of Congress.
You need a business card to come here.
You need a business card.
Which is a different thing.
It's a different
than
vibe.
It was,
you know,
in 06.
If you're sort of a lefty nonprofit in D.C., you send a staff contingent to Netroots Nation.
Yeah.
And that wasn't true in 2006.
And the nature of the Netroots has changed, too, in some respects.
That's true. I mean, you know, you've seen the blogosphere become much more professionalized. You still have people here who are Daily Coast commenters and diarists, which I think is awesome. But that was almost all of it in 2006
because
it was an organic
thing.
Right. And now it's, you know, the Atlantic sends somebody.
Yeah, in 2006.
And the sends somebody.
You know, we came as Air America in 2006. We were the man.
That's right.
We were probably the most significant institutional player.
The other weird thing is that as the staff level has gone up, the national media level has gone down.
I mean,
in the first Networks Nation, it was this curiosity.
Right.
There were all these
it was a freak show for them.
Media. Yeah, and they were in the zoo. And now they're like, oh.
Now it's more of like almost like a trade conference in some respects. The interesting thing, though, to me that, you know, is fascinating is that it, in some ways I almost feel like there is more quasi-independent blogging happening on the right in some respects because they are, you know, or I should let me rephrase.
Not sure
it.
We know if it's independent or not.
Well, no, but that's my point.
Ostensibly,
that's why I say quasi because you know in 2006 there was very few group blogs. And there were some, but that was not the main thing was, you know, Digby, and I know you used to write there, but it was more like a guest poster.
Absolutely.
You would do it occasionally, fill in for, and that's impossible to sustain on the left because it's such a difficult job to do. It's so relentless, and there is no funding and no institutional support. And so people have had to...
Well, and then you have 800-pound gorillas like the Huffington Post or Talking Points Memo. And they've kind of, you know, crowded out the space and Daily Coast to an extent.
Right. And I think that it's sort of interesting in some way, like that things have become more professionalized, but more institutionalized in some respects. And you don't have the same sense here that this is a group of outsiders.
Well, and actually, that's something that, you know, I used to work with Netroots Nation. It's a conversation that, you know, Sam, you and I have had for a while, is that, you know, I think you probably made this analogy better. Is I think you originally talked about the Sundance as a film festival and how it began as sort of an outsider, you know, sort of on the fringe, independent thing. Mm-hmm. And then when it sort of got close to the studios and when, you know, actors started, you know, getting involved, they basically had to create, you know, it sort of moved away from the margin. I think, Daily, you know, the Networks Nation, what was the alternative Sundance?
Slam Dance. And now there's four alternatives to Slam Dance.
Right.
There's Slum Dance.
Slum Dance.
And I don't think Networks Nation is in any, you know, it is in too much danger of losing its sort of claim to the margin or claim to its outsider status. But, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, every major national union here, these, you know, we're sitting in the exhibit hall, there's a lot of money here in just in these organizations.
Oh, tell me about it, dude. Look at this. Look at this.
There's a very nice picture of you, in fact.
That's the Ring of Fire. We're sitting in the Ring of Fire booth. But, yeah, I mean, look at this thing. I put this on foam core.
Yeah, the champagne here is a bit too much, buddy.
I know. It's a little elegant.
But, I have mimosas for all my guests.
Look at the other, if you look at the gas.
Crystal chandelier this time? Really? You needed that?
Right, exactly.
But I think that, I work for Russ Feingold now, and I think part of what's important is, if you look at panel selection, if you look at the keynotes, a lot of them are going to be saying things that are not necessarily loyal to the party, and I think that's to the Democratic Party, and I think it's a really healthy and sort of crucial thing to anchor this convention. You don't want to become, what's the new version of the Take Back America conference? What do they call it now? After we won, they call it something else.
Yeah.
It can't be sort of Take Back America West.
Right.
It
you can't be, sort of be Truck Back America.
Right, exactly. And I think I think it's great that Network Station has never been in D.C. or close to D.C. I hope it never goes to D.C.
Right.
That outsider
That'll
margin,
be the one I skip.
Yeah. That's what makes
and
this
conference
important.
I think what's going to be interesting over these 3 days is the discussions about where we go as progressives. I think there's a lot of questioning and a lot of, just wondering what this all is about at this point when you're
Did I imagine this, or did I see something that said that Debbie Schultz Wasserman said that John Huntsman's going to have problems differentiating himself policy-wise from Barack Obama? Did I make that up?
I don't remember hearing that, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Scott, will you Google that?
No, he's saying no.
This is like sitting here with Evan. I'm like paying attention.
There's a
30-second delay. But, if that's the case, it's stunning that he has no sense of irony. But I know you have to go.
Yes.
All right, thank you so much from Fire Dog Lake. And stepping right into the hot seat.
Relief
is Amanda Marco. Okay. And Gaius Publius, you want to join too? We'll have both you guys come up. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gaius, sorry. I wasn't sure about that. I was going to ask you about that. Oh, come on, come say it into the mic. You don't have to. Amanda Marcotte from Pandagon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What is Pandagon? What is it? Where do they come from?
My co-blogger, Jesse Taylor, came up with it. The idea was that if pandas ruled the world, their military would be based in the Pandagon. He came up with it when he was in college.
Wow.
And we've just been stuck with it, kind of.
Do you know specifically what kind of drugs were involved in contemplating that?
I don't want to speculate.
All right, that's fair enough. Fair enough. And also joining us from America Blog is Gaius Publius. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, you got it right. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And how long have you been blogging America Blog?
1 year anniversary last May.
And I love your stuff. Obviously, you also post stuff from the Majority Report, which I also love. But is this your first time? This is not your first time at Netroots Nation, is it?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
What are your thoughts? It's only been 12 hours.
It's the most interesting trade show I've been at. I've never been at a trade show where more than 50% of the booths weren't set up until the morning of the convention.
Right, there you go. Yes, there's a little bit of winging it here. Yeah,
but I'm from the Pacific Northwest, and they do high-tech out there.
Ah, so is it, you do a lot of high-tech trade?
I used to in an ex-life.
I understand. Now, Amanda, you've been coming here for quite a while.
Yeah, I think I've come to everyone since the second one.
Okay, and what is your sense on how it has changed a little bit?
I think it's become more insular.
More insular?
Yeah, like for just the Netroots, whereas like I think when I first went in Chicago, it was just overwhelmed with mainstream media.
Okay.
And I think the thing that's amused me the most is the development.
Now, that one in Chicago, of course, was where all the presidential candidates, or at least primary candidates, showed up. So that was probably an anomaly in some ways.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, I think the funniest thing that's changed for me is the existence of the right online.
Right. Oh, yeah. There's always a right-wing conference that sort of, shadows this one.
Yeah, it started the third year in Austin.
And do you go over there?
I stuck my head in this morning. I was going to the gym, and I walked by it.
Wait, they're in this building?
They're in the Hilton.
Oh, you're shitting me.
No, no. I actually offered to help a woman carry her materials to the conference because she looked like she was weighing, you know, weighed down by them. And I was kind of like, can I help? And then I felt weird about that.
Like you should not even help them
or
carry
just
stuff.
Them the wrong way.
Yes, you're carrying all sorts of literature to subjugate women.
Yes.
How does that make you feel that you're actually literally carrying the water for the right?
You could certainly put it where it belongs.
Now, would you say that, is this a particularly, is it my imagination or is this a particularly tenuous time for women's rights? I mean, we're talking reproductive rights, I guess, maybe specifically, but there just seems to be a greater assault on reproductive rights now than we even saw during the Bush administration era. Is that an accurate description?
Yes, yeah. There are almost 1,000 bills in state legislatures right now attempting to limit abortion and contraception. We have 3 states that have tried to defund Planned Parenthood.
I am going to assume that the right wing is no more or less misogynist now, or no more or less, fundamentalist now. What's changed?
2 things. The first is that I think they've given up on gay marriage as an issue, largely. So their attention's not
so
divided anymore.
So disappointing, isn't it? So disappointing. It's going to be so discouraging, the idea that gay people may actually end up being citizens.
Yeah. So if gay people can be citizens, women can't. That's
right.
The thing,
someone has to be. I mean, my sense is that there has been a long-term plan to gain control by fundamentalists and by the hardcore right wing to gain control of local mechanisms.
Yes.
And I think what we're seeing is that come to fruition.
Yes.
That they have now hit that critical mass where they can actually get this legislation passed instead of one lone moron in the state legislature saying, you know, I'm going to have a fetus testify, and his colleagues are invariably his colleagues.
And there's a primo organizing mechanism in ALEC, which is highly funded.
Tell us about that. Bring the mic up.
Executive Council?
Sorry, you've got the short mic. I've got to figure out what to do about it.
The American Legislative Executive Council is an organizing arm for that state's laws throughout the state's movement. And they're extremely well-funded. They've got 80% of their members are politicians, Republican politicians from the states, and 80% of their funding, I'm making these numbers up, but I'm not off by much, 80% of their funding comes from billionaires, including Koch brothers. So they write laws that, ALEC writes laws that can then be taken back to state legislatures and put into form to be bills. And it's an extremely effective hub. And what we see is the radiation into the rim of the wheel. We're not looking at the hub of the circle. Without that hub of the circle, they would have to be doing what we have to be doing, which is making connections around the rim with each other.
Right.
They've got a highly funded command and control structure that we don't have. And
people can underestimate. I mean, look, the people who are in state legislatures are not the sharpest tacks in the book. You know, they're not. I mean, never mind the federal Congress, but these are not the sharpest, most ambitious people in the world. But when they get handed this, literally on a silver platter, here's the legislation, here's something you can demagogue, here's something that's going to help you get reelected, here's something that, pulls at your heartstrings and your lifelong desire to subjugate women, here it is, and run with it. And they say, thank you, and all they got to do is go down and submit it to the clerk at that
point. It's called a win-win.
Right. Yeah. We don't have anything like that, do we?
No, we have no organizing structure. I've been
certainly
asking,
not writing
I've been
laws.
Asking for a year, where are our billionaires?
Well, you can turn on a Bill O'Reilly and he'll tell you.
Yes, right.
I do believe they have a running list on Fox News of who our billionaires are.
Haven't gotten a check, though.
Well, yeah. Let me ask you, no, then you won't get a check. And then, you know, we were just talking about that is, to me, one of the things that I notice here when I look around is that there should be more of the bloggers who were started 6-7 years ago when they first came to this should be at this point so well-funded that they're all having their individual parties, that they all have their own booths, that they're handing out, you know, I should be writing right now with an Eschaton pen, and I should be, and I should have my, you know.
Adidas Tycler.
Exactly. I should have my, you know, my America blog sweatsuit. That's what it would be on the right if there was an equivalent.
Oh, that I can get you.
Well, but and we don't have that funding. And here's the question. We're, as progressives, you know, David Dayan was just on. He was saying one of the challenges for people at this event is going to be like, what do we do next as progressives? Because we fought for so long this notion of we're going to get Bush out of office. We're going to get in a Democrat. We're going to have control of the three branches of government. We had that, and a lot of people are disappointed, and rightfully so. Maybe I'm just, you know, sort of apocalyptic in my own perspective, but I don't see the momentum going in the direction that would favor progressives. And knowing what we know here, that we don't have a central command and control structure, how does this change?
America learns from disaster. And America has counted historically, every 70 years, on a heroic figure with his heart in the right place. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt. We're at about that 70-year point. We're actually a little past it.
Well, yeah, but
Obama
isn't that
disaster? Obama is not that figure. We don't have a disaster yet. It's been averted, and America hasn't learned yet.
You don't think that the economic crash was a disaster of that level? I feel like people are truly struggling out there.
It was blunted, and now it's going to be a slow-motion decline, and it's that frog cooking in the pot. At some point, the frog will jump out, but it's going to have third-degree burns when it does. But until that point, I hate to say this because I want to be hopeful, and I would like to live in a country that doesn't have an effective civil war going on, but we kind of don't learn until there's a serious crash that everybody recognizes as a crash that affects them. So they can stop pointing the finger at women and minorities and start pointing the finger at, oh, my God, I'm the deserving and I'm not getting. Until you've got a critical mass of people like that, you don't get that kind of change. And I kind of hate saying that. I kind of hope I'm wrong.
I think you're absolutely right, actually. I mean, I think that the perspective that that what happened in 2008 was a disaster actually is more nuanced than we might know, because I think there are a lot of people who are out there suffering, and it is but the suffering is not acute. It is a slow, stressful grind. I mean, I know people who are just who are just every day they're in the same situation. They're like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm going to do. But it's not there's just a lot of people, I think, right on that bubble who just live every day with a tremendous amount of stress and are living week to week or riding a credit card. And there just has not been a really acute and it may be we may be a year away from it. I don't think we're going to have a better sense of this for the next until a couple months down the road, because if we keep heading in the direction that the economy appears that it's heading in now, I think it's going to be quite clear that we're going to hit another bump, and there's not going to be any way to blunt it this time.
I would think the next turning point is going to be the results of the 2012 election. I don't think we're going to know until after that election and after people digest what the consequences are that we see the next decision point for the country. Just my guess.
You know, and I could ring a note of optimism and point out that a lot of the reactionary politics that are driving our country are very, the people that believe these things are very much towards the higher end of the age spectrum, you know, and younger people are far more liberal. I mean, this is a problem that it may burn itself out over time.
Well, you know what? I mean, I think we're talking about two different things here. I mean, because when you talk about reactionary politics, are you talking from a social perspective? Yeah, I mean, because I think you're right. I think we're seeing this definitely. But I see, I think the anti-gay, anti-woman, anti-black, anti-immigrant, I think all of those positions are held by a demographic that's essentially dying out.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the anti-gay agenda this year, that's why they're moving, because, frankly, I think the people who are really against it are just so out of what's going on in society that they just basically like, whatever.
I agree. You know, and, I think the economics, somewhat, you can't untie them from the race and the immigration and those concerns. Like, I think a lot of populist right-wing sentiment against taxes, against progressive taxation is rooted in a sense that they're taking money from white people and giving it to black people and immigrants.
That's right.
And once that has less of a pull on people, I think we'll see a dramatic shift in people's economic views.
But Gaius, are we suffering? I mean, I think that's part of it. There's no doubt in my mind that the idea that the anti-welfare, the anti-Medicare, that is a function of, and I think Tim Weiss, you know, spoke about this last year at Netroots Nation, in fact, that it's very much tied into this notion of, well, black people are getting this stuff now. It's not just white people are getting it. Black people are getting it, and it's become more problematic. But the problems that we're dealing with now, at least from progressives, has to do with neoliberalism, neoliberal economic views, which doesn't necessarily have a problem with welfare. I mean, but there's more of a problem with, in some respects, sort of the middle class. I mean, the welfare is there to maintain some measure of social stability so that we can continue to have policies that help those in the stratosphere in terms of the economics.
Yeah. Amanda is right that I'll broaden out what you're saying, because you're correct. The nation is behind us. The nation is behind progressives. All the polling and all of the messaging responses says, yes, the nation is a progressive nation. Sam is right that the racist group is dying out. You made that point, too. The racist group is dying out. Right now, the steam in the Tea Party billionaire-driven movement is all of that closet racism, closet anti-woman, closet sexism, closet anti-the other. Closet immigrant actually descends into the age groups. When those people die out, it's going to depend upon the numbing down of angry young people, frustrated young people. And I think all of the messaging of the media and of the entertainment media, which is part of this also, messaging comes from entertainment, comes from advertising, comes from mainstream news, is to keep young people unorganized and frustrated and misaligned, because you can advance the cause in the absence of pushback. And there is an end game. I think we're in the third quarter. There will be a point when it's too late. This is not something that's going to go on for 100 years. It's going to be over for this country, one way or the other, in the next, I would say, 20 or 30 years. We may all live to see it. And once the right wing has enough power and enough money to control every election, it's not going to matter what people think. They'll just call it terrorism to bring out the police.
That's a good point. I mean, I had a moment of, like,
sorry,
apocalyptic
about that,
thinking.
Oh, gosh.
This morning I was watching a Good Morning America, and they were covering a story of a socialite caught shoplifting an $11,000 scarf, and it was all about, why did she do this? Why do people shoplift all that? And I'm sitting there going, to me, the story is, why is there an $11,000 scarf?
Right. Yes, that's a good point. That must keep you very, very warm. Well, Amanda Marcotte and Gaius Publius from America Blog, Amanda Marcotte, of course, from Pentagon.net. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to bring in Chris.
It's a Chris. Pleasure, Sam. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Chris, can you sit? Yeah, can you come in? We're going to have Chris Bowers come by. Art, you want to sit in? Okay, Art Brodsky will join us, too. We're just rotating people through here, folks. We are in the exhibition hall, as it were. Tom tomorrow is going to be joining us briefly. Where is he? Art Brodsky and Chris Bowers. Art Brodsky is from Public Knowledge. What is Public Knowledge, Art?
Hey, Sam, we are a group in Washington that's fighting on all our digital rights issues, from trying to keep AT&T from taking over T-Mobile to keeping the Internet open and, you know, fighting a good fight for everybody that believes in openness and freedom online.
Yeah, but shouldn't we be thankful to corporations all the time for everything?
Of course.
Okay.
Let's just clear that up, okay?
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, this is obviously net neutrality is a big issue.
We just can't thank them too much.
We'll talk about net neutrality in a second. I want to talk, and I also want to just introduce Chris Bowers. Now from, you've been there for a while, I guess, at Daily Kos. What specifically are you? You're like the political director.
No, actually, I'm the campaign director. And thanks for having me on. David Neer is our political director, but what I run all of the activist campaigns on Daily Kos.
And this is sort of the – it's interesting that it's the next step for blogs. I mean, that has taken place over probably the past year or two, that they have become – not just disseminators of opinion and news, but actually have created a mechanism which to take action on this.
Absolutely. We view it as a way, I mean, it's something Daily Kos has done since 2004. It's been raising money directly for candidates. And we view it as a way that, you know, it can help further empower our community. The community being the most indispensable thing on Daily Kos is, you know, we try to find ways that they can talk to each other, you know, discuss news with a purpose, but also then move to take action on it as well.
And give me your sense. I mean, obviously, I think, you know, Chris, when you were first here probably five years ago, not here, obviously, in Minnesota, that would have been awkward because I think the convention was in Vegas at that time. But you were, I think, you were at MyDD at that time?
I was, yes.
And Art, I forgive me, I don't know what you were, where you were doing at
that
time.
I was just, you know, wandering the streets. Looking for something to do.
Were you at the first daily yearly?
No,
Kos?
I'm more sporadically attending.
Give me your sense, both of you. Let's start with you, Chris. What has changed both with this convention, but also online? Because you have been at some of the most influential blogs that have existed, MyDD, Open Left, Daily Kos. Tell me what's changed.
Well, 2006 was perhaps at the apex of well, maybe not the apex, but we felt like we were on a steep upward slope in terms of rising influence and power, and a lot of us didn't necessarily know where it was going. And that was also right in the middle of the Lamont-Lieberman fight, which arguably was the peak of blog power after Lamont was able to defeat Lieberman in primaries. And you know, now we're in a different place. Is that it's certainly where we can't honestly say that we're on the same upward rising power of in national politics that the Netroots was in 2006. And we're also dealing with a new media landscape where a lot of institutional, like long established media institutions have started their own blogs and, mm-hmm. and are doing a lot of the things that we were doing, but you know, they can maybe even pay people a lot more to do them. So we're in a new place where we have to struggle a bit more to sort of define ourselves as an independent political players. And
let me talk, and both of you can give me your reactions to this. Because institutions have moved into this space, both media institutions and liberal institutions, and offer really one of the only, more or less, one of the only viable economic models for an individual blogger, what does that do to their positions? I mean, have we lost? I mean, well, listen, I know that we've lost voices who cannot talk in the same way they could have 6 years ago in a 360 on any topic, because there's always one area where I got to be careful because my employer doesn't necessarily agree with this. This could cause me problems in an institutional level, which has in some ways sort of blunted our power, because our power before was that we had no one supporting us, but that's not sustainable because we're not getting that money that they do on the right.
And that's always been the problem. I mean, the late lamented Air America was the problem. that, you know, you had people who were speaking finally to an audience but didn't have the economics behind it. But at the same time, you've got something that's more diverse. And I think it's sort of like NBA basketball. I mean, and Olympic basketball. For years and years, Americans dominated the game. And then all of a sudden, you had these, you know, the Dirk Nowitzkis of the world and, you know, the foreign players who came in, and their game basically caught up to ours. And that's what's happened. So we have to, you know, still distinguish ourselves by what we say and what we do, and try and break through the clutter by finding people and have people finding us who agree with what we're saying. I mean, we're a little public interest group in Washington, and the day that AT&T announced that it was going to take over T-Mobile, spontaneously, we got like 200 emails saying, what can we do about this? So, you know, there are people out there who want to find things, and there's lots more to be found.
Chris, give me your sense on it, because I think what Art is saying is true to a certain extent, but I'm almost talking on a more sort of like a micro level, that we have lost voices basically because there is no independent funding. And so once you are, I mean, listen, I know this because I've gotten fired, I got fired from Air America almost 5 times. They tried to fire me at different points because we kept having different owners and they had their own little pet things that... the fact is that if you are reliant on an institution for your funding, particularly an advocacy institution, there are certain areas where you have to be careful, and because you can be used against them. And how do we deal with that?
Well, there is no good market for local news, which is one of the reasons why local bloggers have had such a difficult time. And as you were saying before, you know, when the New York Times and the Washington Post can pay people huge amounts of money or very good salaries, at least, to run blogs, it's going to be very difficult for someone as a hobbyist to compete with that.
And so, it's going to change the nature of their voice too, won't it?
Yeah, and it's basically allowing more established, more well resourced, well heeled institutions to sort of do what we were doing, and arguably not only take audience share but arguably do it better. And so I think that perhaps one of the big mistakes that at least I looking back at 2006 when this whole thing started, I think I often mistook the medium for the message, that there was something special that because we were having that because we had blogs and we were using other new online platforms and email activism lists, that somehow just the use of those new technologies, new publishing techniques, that's what made us special. But what was actually making us special at the time is that we were doing things like the Lamont versus Lieberman primary, that we were able to demonstrate that there were large numbers of people who were willing to back our message of, withdraw the troops from Iraq, in opposition to both the Democratic and Republican leaderships. And it was the demonstration that we had popular backing for that message through the primary. That's what was making us powerful back then. It wasn't really so much the different mediums we were employing. We only used those because we had to, because
right.
we couldn't use the established networks, or we couldn't get on big TV shows or have prominent places in the Washington Post editorial pages. So the important thing is to always remember that it's the message, and it's the ideas that we are pushing that matter, and not so much the specific mediums that we're using.
Right, and I think that's the point, is that what Chris has done through his career, and just what my little story about public knowledge is that's what the Post doesn't do. Right. If you can read a fixed blog on the Post, and that's the end of it. But if you read your stuff on Daily Coast or our stuff at Public Knowledge, and say, "Wow, I'm really pissed about this. What do I do?" It gives you an outlet to do stuff.
Right.
Sign a petition or contribute money or whatever your campaign might be for an issue, and that's really important.
Let me ask you, Art, specifically about net neutrality, because I know the Republicans, in some ways, are actually trying to gut the net neutrality deal or structure that has been set up by the FCC. As someone who is a strong advocate of net neutrality, should I be upset about that?
Yeah, I mean, here's the weird part. It disappeared for a while because the FCC passed their rules last December.
But weren't those rules rather anemic?
They were totally anemic. And the only reason those rules existed in that form is that AT&T beat the heck out of the FCC into submission. I mean, you'll hear some members of Congress say, oh, you know, AT&T was forced to accept these rules by, you know,
right,
by the...
Of course
no,
not.
It was AT&T and just a massive two shock and awe campaigns beating the crap out of the FCC. And so we got totally anemic rules. And then they sort of disappeared while the FCC has sort of been going through this entire legal rigmarole before they're actually published in the Federal Register, because you can't file suit against them until they're official. So that's, they haven't yet been published. So the issue sort of disappeared. And then even probably at some point in this afternoon, the House Republicans are bringing it back.
Well, shouldn't I be happy that the Republicans are going to gut these rules? Because frankly, I would like them to start over again. I would like them to do what they should have done in the first place, is classify these carriers, you know, under a, what is it, level two or
title
two. Title two, and actually legitimately regulate them.
If I thought that there was a snowball's chance in hell that that would happen, I'd agree with you.
Well, but, I appreciate the optimism.
But this FCC will not do that.
Right.
And for the moment, at least, it's better to have something on the books than nothing. So what's going to happen is the House will, they did one of these backdoor deals through what they call a spending bill, an appropriations bill, where they slip in some language that says, it's basically, thou shalt not. The FCC shall not spend money to enforce these rules. And that's the backdoor way of gutting it. And that's going to go through a subcommittee today and a full committee next week and, you know, proceed apace.
All right, Chris, finally, let me ask you, what's the most important thing that we should be thinking about right now? What's the biggest problem facing us as progressives?
Structurally or like what political fights should
when you
should we
when I know about? That you probably spend an inordinate amount talking about something at home with your friends all the time, what is it? You choose.
We have to finally win a campaign where we defeat both the Democratic and Republican establishments electorally, thereby proving that if they cross us, we can actually remove them from office. And until we've done that, we have not done that to this point. We will never have the kind of political power necessary to pass the kind of legislation that we want.
So we need to become a teabagging or a Grover Norquist in that type of structural sense.
Absolutely. The Tea Party, as much as we mock them or as much as we think that they're AstroTurf, they have done that and we have not.
Is he one of those guys?
Do you know?
He very well could be.
Well, let's sit down. Let's meet him. And Joe Sudbeck, guys, Art Brodsky from Public Knowledge, thank you so
much. Sam.
Thanks,
Chris
Sam.
Bowers from Daily Kos. Yes, please. We just got people coming in. Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking for Tom tomorrow. Okay. I'll look for you in about 5 minutes, 7 minutes. Okay. So sitting down now is Joe Sudbeck, of course, you're as frequent of a guest on the Majority Report as anybody is. We don't do repeats. From America Blog, of course. And I can't pronounce your first name.
No worries. It's Ilya Shaman.
Ilya Shaman. He's running for Congress in, Illinois.
Illinois' 10th Congressional District.
Illinois' 10th.
Held by a Republican Tea Party guy named Bob Dold.
Joe, will you sell him for us?
You know what? He's going to be moving into a new, it's a redistricted district that's going to have more Democratic members. Illinois is a state that has completely trended Democratic. He used to work at Move On, so he's one of us. He's a progressive, and I think if we realized anything from the past couple of years, we need more real progressives in Congress. We need someone who actually gets the issues and gets them from the progressive perspective, who isn't afraid. I think when you have worked on Move On, you're pretty much not afraid.
Right.
And I think that's one of the problems with too many of our elected officials. So that's my sales pitch. Vote for Ilya in the primary in March. What day is it in March?
It's March 20th.
Who are you running against in the primary?
We've got a couple of candidates jumping in. We just got a new district map, and like Joe said, it's very Democratic. So a lot of folks are looking at it as an opportunity to try to win the seat.
Is there DCCC support for any specific candidate? Is there DNC support?
There's not. DCCC, I think, learned their lesson from a battle in Illinois 6th a few years ago between Tammy Duckworth and Christine Sigalis. So I'm hoping they stay neutral. And, you know, we had Governor Dean's support last weekend. He was out there in the district.
I was going to say, because if you got the if somebody else had gotten the DCCC backing at this point, I would immediately call for money to you right now, but I'm going to do it anyways. What is your website?
It's shamanforcongress.com.
Shamanforcongress.com. It's not on your card, dude.
It is. It's S-H-E-Y-M-A-N for congress.com. Maybe it's not.
It's not.
Sam's advice and get better cards.
So what is the number one problem do you think this fall that we're facing right now? I mean, from a progressive standpoint.
I think there's two. I think we see the Republicans dismantling the foundations that have made the middle class possible, middle class lives like mine. And I see far too often Democrats who fail to stand up and fight back. So that means putting people to work, restoring tax fairness and rolling back the Bush tax cuts, and also making investments in America's future, something that the other party just won't do. And our party fails to make the case for far too often.
Right. I mean, it's a very difficult time, I think, and we're facing. I don't know how this gets better, frankly. Now, wait, is there a special election happening there? Why is there a primary? When is this primary happening?
Our primary is March 20th of next year.
Oh, of next year. Okay, yeah. Good. So you're getting a good early start.
So we got started in February and March when people thought it was far too early and we were crazy. But we said this is a winnable district. And unlike incredibly liberal-based districts, this is a chance to show that you can run as a bold progressive in a swing district and win, and model for other candidates from the DCCC side how you can win by standing up for your base and with your base and for working people.
You know, there was an interesting development that happened, and I can't remember, and you may recall this because I think this is a conversation that was going around for a while, that one of the advantages that corporate money has in the Democratic Party, this is probably true in the Republican Party, but that a guy like Steny Hoyer is well-liked, apparently, across the caucus. He is, I think he would have no problem with me saying he's a corporatist. I mean, one of the advantages he has is that his fundraising is much easier than, say, Jim McGovern, who was my congressman when I lived in Massachusetts. And Jim McGovern has to raise his money not from corporate interests. The dollar amounts are smaller. They don't come in big chunks. He doesn't have professional fundraisers. Whereas Steny Hoyer does. And so Steny Hoyer is freed up now to go to other people's districts and to help them raise money. And so that he begins to build coalitions. He collects favors. And meanwhile, Jim McGovern, if he ever had any desires to be a broader leader in the party, doesn't have the ability to help people out in the same way that Steny Hoyer does. And I don't care what business you're in. You know, at one point, if you learn your lesson, some of us haven't always done that, you're going to move further in that arena if you gravitate towards the people who are helping you. How do we deal with that problem?
Look, I think there's two answers, and you're exactly right. We, in the past 2 months, already have 1,000 small donors from around the country, building a base of people who are bought into the campaign, who give you $5 a month, and then go knock on doors and make phone calls. That's how we win the election. But going forward, we actually do have a good model in Jan Schakowsky, who has spent the past, since 1998, building power for progressives within the caucus. After you get elected, work with other progressive members, organize together. You know, I think the key is to be willing to take a risk and take on a fight where you might not win. And when I was at Move On, I think some of the work we were doing with allies on the public option, where we saw progressives who stood up, who signed a letter in support of a public option, were rewarded by their base. And I think that's what we have to do more of, bring the outside progressive groups in to support the leaders in Congress who do the work that progressives want them to do, and help show that we will provide rewards for those Democrats who are willing to stand up. And in that way, I think we can start building coalitions, and over time, not just win the majority, but actually help create a movement to rebuild the middle class.
Right. I mean, on some level, we're going to need more people who are not engaged in politics typically to start getting more angry. I mean, is that not right?
Yeah, I think it's exactly right. And I think one of the problems we've had over the past couple of years since we've had the Obama presidency is that they haven't really done much to instill excitement in people who care about issues who might not be involved politically.
Well, haven't they on some level done almost actively done the opposite?
I think absolutely. You know, I mean, right now the president claims as one of his big victories the passage of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And it turned out to be a great victory, but they weren't going to do it in 2010. They had a plan that they didn't want Don't Ask, Don't Tell done in the year 2010. When you have a, if you remember, Secretary Gates said he wanted a study that would be done in December 1st. When you call for a study to be done in December 1st and don't want legislation until after December 1st, you're not talking about the lame duck. You're talking about 2011. So they had to come kicking and screaming to that victory, and it's become one of his great victories.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think, I have a theory that when you have a neoliberal agenda that does not focus on the middle class, as we've been talking about, that the last refuge for a left of center, theoretically, administration is gay rights. That the Clintons came in sort of wanting to prove their bona fides, coming from the head of the DLC, essentially set up to bring more corporate money into Democratic politics.
Yep.
And they came in with this, and the idea was that we can appeal to the left from a social perspective. And while pursuing neoliberal economic policies behind the scenes a little bit, because people are, you know, look, people on the left, people know gay people.
Right.
And it is a much less nuanced issue, in my estimation. Am I going to afford this person that I work with, that I know, that's my uncle, that's my cousin, that's my niece, the same rights that I have? That's a much less nuanced issue than, hey, you know, maybe if we, the difference between $500 billion in stimulus and how it's targeted, and what goes to tax cuts or a two-year moratorium on payroll taxes, that's a much more sophisticated issue that if that gets broken down and catches fire, then we have problems. And in fact, we saw that happen, didn't we? I mean, it's not a coincidence that this bone, in some ways, was thrown during a debate about economics.
Right, right.
Right? During the tax cut deal.
Right.
What's your sense about that?
Well, it's an interesting thing because I think they like to talk about supporting gay rights and LGBT equality, but they don't want to do it. And
well, of course, they never want to do anything.
They never want to do anything. And even, I mean, last year was really phenomenal because the president said in the State of the Union, I'm going to work on Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal this year. And then within days, his deputy chief of staff, now campaign manager, Jim Messina, was telling gay groups, we're not doing it this year. We don't have the votes.
Right.
And it's going to be too hard and blah, 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 which is typical of what we've come to expect from them. So we really had to force them to do it, and I think probably part of the reason, I mean, it was not one of their top agenda items. The reason actually we got to Don't Ask, Don't Tell was because the omnibus failed, and there was very little space. I mean, going back to December of 2010, it was a crazy time. We lost in early December on the defense authorization bill. Then the Democrats miraculously came up with a new procedure that none of us has heard before that could bypass a few steps. The House would pass it, send it over, and it was sitting there, and we only got to the floor because the big omnibus bill failed. And the president, I mean, to be honest, he did get the report done. He, you know, got Gates and Mullen on board, but they didn't really make any phone calls till the very last minute. And I think there may have been a piece of that they knew they needed to do something. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell, let's say at the time, there was about 80% support.
Right.
We had the Cheneys on our side.
Right.
It was as much of a political no-brainer as existed, and it was still a complicated battle to get the White House to accept a victory on a progressive issue.
Well, I think there's one more piece to this. You know, if you look at Wisconsin in 2010, somewhere between 30 and 35% of AFL-CIO members voted for Scott Walker.
Right.
And when you ask them why, they'll say it was guns or choice.
Yeah.
And then the story goes, somebody will say, I didn't realize they were coming for my job.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference in 2012. Look, I'm running on a 100% pro-equality platform. But I think the reason this is going to be a good year for Democrats and for progressives is that people who in the past weren't with us on social issues suddenly see what's at stake, which is
right.
The entire middle-class life that they've come to expect.
Kevin Drum wrote a really fascinating piece called, I think, Plutocracy Now, where he really delineates when that cleave happened between union and essentially another progressive part of the Democratic Party in the 60s, where the union guys said, I'm not going to hang out with those hippies and those fags, and the hippies and fags said, I'm not going to hang out with those reactionary morons. And that's when that cleave happened, and the Democratic Party no longer provided the institutional support for the unions. The unions then were no longer able to really support the Democratic Party in terms of money, and then Democrats turned to corporations. And that, I mean, certainly what's happened in Wisconsin this year, I think, shows that, you know, when a protest starts with teaching assistants at University of Madison and brings out cops and firefighters and
right.
welders, that cleavage is closing.
Well, here's the question, though, Sam, and I think is has the White House watched that, watch what happened in Wisconsin and what's happening in these other states, and will they then stand up for progressive policies, progressive economic policies over the next few months and into going into 2012,
no.
Or are they going to negotiate a lot of this away? And that's the big fear we have. We've seen that their negotiating tactic is to negotiate with themselves and to be held hostage by the Republicans. And if you know,
are you sure they're negotiating themselves? I mean, are you sure that Tim Geithner doesn't come in there and say reportedly that stimulus is sugar, that we need to take care of the bondholders? Are you sure that their worldview is one in which they feel they're negotiating with themselves, or they're saying, like, not only are we not negotiating with ourselves, I said $800 billion, and we got $800 billion. Not only am I not negotiating, I hammered them right to the point where I wanted them.
Yeah, I think they're negotiating with themselves. I think they start, instead of starting at a place where they could get to that point.
Do you think they wanted more?
Do I think they wanted more? I think that they were told they needed more for the economy to get better. I think that
by
what happened by economists like Stiglitz and Krugman and others.
What makes you think they even listen to
them? Let me just say.
Any more than listen to you or I.
I remember hearing a story about, I'm reading a report, and this made perfect sense to me, the story of Rahm Emanuel going to see Olympia Snow. I'm from Maine, right? I'm from Maine.
I didn't realize that.
So Rahm goes into Olympia and says, I need your vote on the stimulus. And her first thing is to say, I need to cut $100 billion. And his response is, okay, I need your vote. Now, this was back in January, early February of 2009, when Barack Obama was on such a high, right? He was so powerful. And instead of going to Olympia Snow saying, actually, we need more, and we're going to go to Maine and make the announcement, they caved. So,
no, but here's an alternate reading of that. Hey, how much money do we really need for this? I don't know. $800 billion. All right. I'm going to go to Olympia Snow. I'm going to tell her we're talking about $1 trillion.
Yeah.
She says cut $100 billion. Okay. Olympia Snow thinks she's won. We're already got another $100 billion in our back pocket that we can go sell off because we actually believe in an economic ideology that isn't you know, a far right one. It's a neoliberal one, which says that the really important thing is down the road is to give confidence to bondholders. Because Geithner has spent his entire life surrounded by bondholders.
Right, right.
And if they're happy, he's happy.
That's
Jim Cramer, they don't know what's going on the street. People are getting killed. What the fuck are you talking about? You're talking about all the guys that you deal with on a daily basis, the only people you know who are panicked because, you know, their $30 million bonus is going to turn into an $18 million bonus.
Look, but we've seen this kind of right-wing economic policy since 1980. Looking out for Wall Street rather than the middle class. And
right.
I think the reality is, I don't know what's going on in the head of Tim Geithner. What I do know is that we are not powerless to stop it. That ultimately we need advocates who will stand up and fight back, regardless of who the president is. Regardless
right.
of whether it's the Bush bailout or a bailout that's proposed and supported by President Obama. The reality is we need a different set of policies, and the Progressive Caucus has led the way in proposing them. And I think we have to find a way to promote that, to reward that, to highlight that. So the alternative isn't, you know, the Geithner plan or the Republican plan. We have to find a way to make the people's budget actually be on the table.
Right. See, I think you're absolutely right about that. That at the end of the day, the idea that he's negotiating with himself and this and that, that's a fool's errand.
Right.
We just need to be enough of an immutable force that it doesn't matter. What's going on? They're negotiating with themselves, and that they can't in any way fight what we're saying. All right. Well, it's tell me again the website.
It's shamanforcongress.com.
SHEYMAN forcongress.com. We will put this up on our site at Majority FM. People should, people. It's a tough time for people, but if you want a truly progressive voice in Congress, folks, shamanforcongress.com, you can read all about it's coming from Move On, honestly, folks.
Really?
What more do you want? And Joe Sudbay from America Blog, thank you so much for joining us.
Always fun talking to you, Sam.
Thanks
Sader.
So much, Sam.
All right, let's get Ari Berman in here. Ari, sit down. And will you get time tomorrow? All right, Berman. Sitting down. Sitting down. Sure. Yeah, I'm in the... We go. And coming to the dais. Yes, please. Tom Tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. Ari Berman from The Nation. You guys have never met each other?
No, I don't think so. This is a great meeting of the minds over here.
Wow. This is fantastic.
Are we broadcasting live?
Yes, I'm on...
Radio Row?
Yeah. You want to talk about education? Hold on. We just talk to Scott for a second, then, yeah. That's the way we do things here.
We don't know.
Yes, it's a little bit loosey-goosey here. Ari Berman from The Nation and Tom Tomorrow. Now, it is 11:50. Okay. I'm looking at my computer. It's still on East Coast time, so I'm a little bit confused. Gentlemen, now, Ari, is this your first? This is not your
first. This is my first Netroots Nation.
Is it really?
Popping the cherry.
I don't know how
I made it this long.
Well, this goes to what I'm saying. It's like it's being infested by institutionalized people. Ari Berman,
the professional left has descended.
Yes, of course. Look, he's wearing a sport coat. Can you believe it?
A sport coat.
I know. Seriously, like an actual blazer.
It's a denim.
I put on the journalist uniform, okay?
There you go.
The jeans and the blazer.
And now, you've been to, how many of these have you been to?
You know, I was at the first one when it was still... Am I talking into this microphone device?
Yeah,
properly?
You got the short mic. I'm sorry.
The tall person on the short mic.
Right.
I was at Yearly Coast the first time out.
We were a little bit. The Majority Report at the time was the first mass media to broadcast from this. And we were actually, Josh Orton was on, we were actually, like, important at that time. we were the biggest institutional presence there because there was no Huffington Post. There was Media Matters had just started.
Right.
I mean, it was...
How many owners was Air America at that point?
Wow. Okay, this is 2006. I think we were three owners in, probably. Three owners in, at least.
And that was, I mean, I guess it was, yeah, that was after... 2004, when you and I got locked out of the Democratic convention somehow. Remember that? They were too full.
Oh, that we mean for the inside
for,
of the.
For, yeah, to
yes.
Get into the,
we were in the basement.
So like, I like the radio. Out of your booth
right.
Because no one could get into
right.
The.
Right.
Did you broadcast from the Republican convention?
I did, yes. In 2004 in New York, I actually did broadcast from the floor. As I was getting grabbed by the Secret Service because I was walking around. There's a video of this. I was walking around with a sign saying, I want to talk to a gay Republican or a log cabin Republican. And I was going, and it was the strangest thing in the world. From one end of Madison Square, like, I was ushered over by a guy, and he goes, I think there's one in California. And I found that guy. I interviewed him. It was one of the strangest interviews because he's a 60-year-old man. Who I was like, how can you stand this party when they are running against when one of their pillars of their electoral strategy is to say that you aren't a first class citizen?
And his response was
almost like breaking down in tears as their backdrop of people who are standing up cheering for whatever sort of fascist thing. He's saying like, if I don't stay in the party, who's left to change it? And I was just like,
I wonder if it's gotten better or worse, because obviously that was the year where they were pushing all those ballot initiatives against gay marriage.
I think it's gotten better for gay people.
Cabins.
Yes, I think so. In the Republican Party, I think it's because just all the gay haters are dying.
Right.
Yeah.
They're just dying off.
And it's weird. Like a lot of the Wall Street billionaires in the GOP are now pro gay marriage. The sort of more socially liberal Upper East Side New Yorkers,
right?
They are now bankrolling some of this stuff, which
well,
is
because
different
they
than
don't,
years
they
past.
Don't, because they don't care, and they realize they don't need that as an electoral strategy anymore.
Yeah.
So they can finally look over to their parties and see their friends and say, hey, I'm not as much of a douchebag as I was 3 years ago.
I just want
my tax cuts.
They want their gay Wall Street friends to give them money too.
All right, so. Give me your sense, Tom, since you've been here. What's changed here? What's changed here and online?
Well, as I say, I was here at the first one, and that was 6 years ago. This is and have not made it back until now, and it's huge. I mean, we were in kind of a rinky-dink Las Vegas hotel.
Yep.
whatever that place was. I don't remember.
I'm sure it's been
really
blown up and torn down by now.
And now I don't. Well, I guess this is an improvement. We're in this sort of basement of this giant convention behemoth.
I believe this is an airport hangar.
Yeah, I believe we are in an airport hangar. It's a much larger thing, obviously.
But in terms of the people who are here, I mean, first of all, it seems to me much younger.
Maybe
I'm just older.
Well, look, it's really just getting started now. So
right.
I haven't really seen that many people yet, apart from the Daily Kos people.
Now, speaking of Daily Kos,
I myself am not getting younger.
none of us are. Speaking of Daily Kos, you are now curating and publishing on Daily Kos.
Yeah, I moved my cartoon to Daily Kos. Marcos Moulitsas made me an offer that
you
could not
refuse.
Basically anchor and curate a comic section. Comics are, especially the kind of all-weekly comics that I do, the art form is not having an easy time of it. Fewer and fewer papers are running the work. Fewer magazines are supporting the cartoonists.
You're pointing at Ari Berman from The Nation,
no.
Who makes all those decisions.
And so this
I
was just
which cartoonists are on or off.
You know, this was just a way where I could do a small positive, rather than just bitch and moan, which is mainly what cartoonists like to do. I could actually attempt to make a small positive difference in possibly reversing this trend. And it's been great. We will have a cartoonist today. We've got a couple more that we haven't rolled out yet, but we're going to have a cartoon every day of the week.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. Now, Ari, give me your sense of changing, not getting so meta, as it were. Wiener's gone.
Wiener's gone.
Did he retire?
Breaking news to Tom tomorrow.
Hey, you know, when you're at a thing like this,
well,
you're in a news bubble.
Well, that's the funniest thing about here is
it's the same thing.
This is the worst time to read progressive blogs.
Yeah, no one knows what's going on.
Everybody's just like open thread.
No, we're all
this is pretty inevitable, though, don't you think?
Do I think it was inevitable? I didn't actually think it was inevitable. I think this decision, frankly, I think his wife said,
yeah,
you had done.
Yeah.
I don't think he made this decision because of the pressure he was getting. I don't think he gave a shit.
No, he certainly seemed pretty stubborn about it all along.
Yeah, I think his wife said, I'm done with this.
Blame her.
No.
It kept getting worse and worse for him, too.
Yes.
So I didn't have a whole lot of sympathy. I thought it was actually kind of a mistake for progressives to fight on this one. Like, what principle are they actually fighting for? I mean, I guess.
Well, was there progressives fighting for? I mean, there's a difference between fighting for it and, you know, I'm not going to name names because I've already fucked myself too much in so many different quarters where I could possibly get a job.
You can say that on internet radio?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I watch a left wing or listen or watch a left wing, commentator. Say, look, Anthony Weiner is a distraction, and then spend 40 minutes talking about Anthony Weiner.
That's why I just didn't write about it. I didn't talk about it. I didn't go on TV to talk about it. I didn't go on radio to talk about it. I just didn't want to talk about it. I felt like that was the best way to deal with it, like just try to ignore it. But we lost
battle. Well, yes, okay, fine. I mean, listen, I was not going to go out there, but, you know, you asked me a question, should he resign or no? No. That's the answer. And there's, you know, why? Because why should he resign? I mean, he didn't break the law, but that's it, period. But, okay, so he's resigning. I don't blame him necessarily, and I don't, you know, and I don't know that it's worth expending political capital to fight for guy, but I don't know why anybody's,
Well, like, we were talking, so we've talked a lot about the whole Elizabeth Warren issue, right? And I was on another radio show, and they said, you know, is the same thing happening to Anthony Weiner that's happening to Elizabeth Warren? And I was like, no, they are completely different issues.
What?
Don't confuse this. And that's where I started.
Has she been sending photographs?
Like, oh, my
yeah,
God.
Exactly. Like, she's not sending crazy photographs on Twitter that at least...
Wait, what? I don't even know what that means.
She's saying, like, the same, they're out to get progressives. That was basically the line. And I find that to be a very confusing argument.
I don't even understand it after you've explained it to me. I mean, look, there is value in going after Anthony Weiner if you're on the left, because it builds your cachet of moral credibility. You know, I have some measure of conservative social values that I'm willing to trot out there so that I can be accepted. You know,
the argument was that the same conservative forces that are trying to bring down Elizabeth Warren were also trying to bring down Anthony Weiner.
Well, so it's just a larger argument that conservatives are trying to bring down liberals.
Yeah.
This is not a huge insight. I mean, this is just the way the world works.
And I don't doubt that Weiner was targeted by Breitbart partly because he was effective, but I don't think you can then make the reach that everyone everyone you're going after, who's a progressive, is getting the same treatment as
Breitbart. Is a creature of opportunity, and he was handed a huge opportunity.
Yeah.
Look, Elizabeth Warren's problem is not that conservatives are gunning after her, right? I mean, Elizabeth Warren's problem is that it took a long time for the neoliberals in the administration to basically accept that this may be an easy win for us with the progressives and to get them through, and then, you know, didn't acknowledge that early enough to do anything about it.
Yeah.
And now they're going to have this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that they cannot run on in 6 to 8 months because it's not going to be working, right? I mean, without a director, what are they going to do with this? It's just going to sit there, and it's going to be one more example that the Republicans are going to now use. They're actually going to run on the administration's inability. I am convinced of this. They're going to run on the administration's inability to get this agency going. I mean, isn't that going to be what Mitt Romney says? He's going to say, you could not even get this this organization off the ground. What's wrong with you?
Right.
I mean, that will be a very novel argument for the same people that are opposing it to say that, but you might
be
right.
Well, Mitt Romney's not.
They will use
what
the whole...
What vote is Mitt Romney taking?
They will use the whole... It sounds like there's like a ping pong tournament.
Sounds like we have a handball
behind us. But they will use all these vacancies on not only the CFPB, but on the broader financial reform, all these posts that are vacant, to say that, you know, Obama is not doing, you know, the proper oversight that he should be. Even though they oppose that oversight, they will still make their argument against him. And it's really indefensible at this point that they haven't filled not only the CFPB, but all these different positions at this point.
Are you guys familiar with Debbie Wasserman Schultz saying that on some show, Huntsman is going to have a problem differentiating his policies from Obama's? Did I imagine that?
Well, right now Huntsman's running to the left of Obama on Afghanistan, which is really interesting, I think. Because he's basically saying we need to pull troops out quicker and pull more out than the administration is saying. Which, obviously, Huntsman is not going to be the Republican nominee, most likely, so it's sort of irrelevant, but it is interesting to have a Republican of that caliber criticizing Obama from the left.
Isn't that problematic for Obama?
So I mean, have we already, has the conventional wisdom already chosen the Republican nominee, or are we all settling on Romney? I mean, what?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the conventional wisdom or more just, like, who's going to beat him. I mean, who do you think is going to beat him?
No, it's a good
point.
Field. But it it's so early.
It's so early,
and
exactly.
I hate making these kind of predictions this early because you get the stupid distraction, the weird story, the scandal, you know, the whole thing goes in some weird direction,
yeah.
And the next thing you know, there's President Bachman.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, with Romney, I mean, it seems like there's probably unlikely to be a major scandal.
Right.
In his past, because
right.
He was vetted last time, and he went through the ringer to some
Well,
extent.
The problem Romney's going to have, and I don't want to get into this too much, because I find this, you know, sort of like just, this is the last vestige of somebody who doesn't want to do their homework,
yeah.
Right? I mean, to be talking yeah. about this far out. But my understanding
I'm
is that
cartoonist.
This is what
I
we
hate
go on
doing
t-
my homework.
No, I appreciate that.
This is what we go on TV
to
do.
Exactly. I have to put on some airs. I'm not going to shit on somebody else who's not going to hire me for some job, so forget that. But my understanding is that Huntsman is really going to do everything he can to make sure that Romney does not get the nomination, because if Huntsman has a shot in anything, it's at 2016, and he's not going to be the second Mormon Barbie doll that is nominated by the Republicans after the first one loses.
Right.
That's not going to happen. But here it is. Okay, Wasserman Schultz, this is at, I'm not sure what it is. This was at, she spoke with Politico's Mike Allen on Wednesday at a breakfast meeting held by the publication. Okay?
I love that headline. But you need to read that headline.
DNC chairman looking forward to working with Republicans beating the crap out of them in 2012. This is from the Daily Caller. Who knows? But here it is. She gave the peep of her bulldog style, calling the 2012 Republican candidates deeply flawed and politely tweaking John Huntsman for not having differentiated himself from Obama. Now, does she not understand the irony that there is a Republican candidate who is going out supposedly trying to win the nomination? We all know that he's not. He's trying to establish himself for 2016. But supposedly going out trying to win the nomination from a bunch of right-wing yahoos who has not differentiated himself from Obama. Does she not realize that the problem might be that Obama has not differentiated himself from a moderate Republican who is in this race thinking that he can win in 2016? I mean, is she not aware of that problem? Do you think there is a problem with progressives who are not going to come out and vote for Obama in 2012?
No. No, I don't. I mean, I think that people, and I would include myself in this, I think there are many, 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 many reasons to criticize Obama, but in the end, I think people are still going to vote for him. I don't believe that saying I disagree with Libya, I disagree with Afghanistan, I don't believe that that, you know, depresses the vote. I find that a really just silly argument.
They're going to have to make this a referendum on whoever it is Obama's running against. And yeah, that's going to be very difficult, I think.
Well, but they know that she can say that because they know that Huntsman most likely will not be the nominee. I mean, basically,
she could say that because she knows that Huntsman won't be the nominee.
Yeah.
And she could say that, I guess, at Politico because outside of people like us, we're not going to ever hear that comment.
No, and no one knows who John Huntsman is. I mean, he's polling at 1% because no one knows who he is. So, but I mean, basically, Huntsman and Obama are essentially both Eisenhower Republicans.
Right.
I mean, they're not that different. I mean, Obama was more raised on the left. Huntsman was more raised on the right. But if you look at their policies, probably they differ more on economic policy. But in terms of foreign policy, things like that, they're not that different. And it is really interesting to me that Huntsman seems to believe there is a constituency for what he's talking about in the Republican Party for getting out of Afghanistan, for getting out of Libya. And
he's running for 2016.
That's an interesting proposition, though, the fact that he's even saying it, that he believes that people are out there want to hear that.
Well, because he's going to say in 4 years when we're completely fucked and nothing has changed in Afghanistan, I was saying this 4 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a Republican to get us out of there because obviously a Democrat cannot do it.
Yeah.
Gentlemen,
I got to run.
I want to thank you for joining me.
It's great to see you.
Ari, really great to see you. You still owe me $200. You know that, right?
Yeah, well, I offered you, we were going to pay it in food.
Yeah, well, there's,
so
I mean, I
it.
Still eat.
Yeah, let's do
I
it.
I still eat.
When we're back in New York.
I bet.
You at Nobu.
Okay. Oh, really?
The Regency. Maybe we can dine at the power
lunch
at the Regency.
Power lunch. See, the two worst dressed people in the entire, what you got? You have a DVD? Are you pitching that?
Norman
or what
Solomon
do you
just gave me this.
Oh, okay.
Do you know him?
No, I don't.
He's running
hey,
for
thank
Congress.
You,
he's an old friend of mine.
Okay.
You should have him on.
And, all right, well, maybe we'll have him on tomorrow. Because the show is over 6 minutes long. We're overdue, and I got to go. We got to have that lunch, right? Tom, tomorrow people can go to. Do you still have this modern
life? ThisModernWorld.com.
ThisModernWorld.com.
You can sort of
sorry.
Check in on, basic Tom Tomorrow News. The cartoon runs every Monday at Daily Coast. There's a cartoon every morning at
yeah,
Daily
folks,
Coast.
Yeah, folks, you got to go check this cartoon out. It's all these are great to. I would imagine are they embeddable?
We're working on that. Not right now.
That's would be a great feature
yeah.
because then they become sort of like a little way to guss up a post. Maybe
we're thinking about it. It's an idea.
Don't think about it. Do it. There's got to be a way of doing that.
Sure.
I would imagine you could even just put it up on YouTube.
Yeah, well, possibly. I'm not sure the quality would hold for that. But anyway, for the meantime, until we get that
Flicker.
Going, come to Daily Coast.
Flicker! Come to Daily Coast in the meantime, folks. I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm doing this. I'm one to talk. I can't. All of my online presence is completely effed up. I don't even know if anybody heard this. And for all I know right now,
this could be the whole audience.
This could be it right here. All right, folks, that is our show for today. I am going to try and look up where the music is that we outro the show with, and see if I can get this right. Tomorrow on the program, I will be here, and we will have more stuff. Let's see if this works. God, come on. So,
should we start humming?
Yeah. How come I can't? Why can't I do this? What the? I'm clicking my... Clicking. There we go. So, folks, we'll see you tomorrow on the program. See you tomorrow, folks. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid.